You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 323, Dr. Ben Witherington, the third. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, the third, actually. And he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, it's been a busy week, you know, but this will be a nice break, actually. I've done lots of videos and interviews this week, really almost 10 hours of that. And, you know, last night I was feeling just kind of washed out about it, but I knew we had Ben coming on. And so it's like, yep, this will be a good break, good conversation. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, your demons book has finally come out. So
yep.
Have you gotten any feedback? Yeah, finally. Have you gotten any feedback about that yet?
Oh, yeah. You know, people have really enjoyed it. We've gotten some Instagram things and, you know, social media, you know, feedback and whatnot, and email, of course. But yeah, so I think it's off to a good start. And, you know, I'm so thrilled to be able to say, look, I wasn't lying. Okay, it was real. Here it is. It's out.
Well, we have a great conversation happening today, Mike. Who we got?
We got Ben Witherington III, who should be a familiar name to a lot of people who listen to the podcast or who watch, you know, Discovery Channel, History Channel, A&E. I mean, you've probably seen Ben's face before.
Or even 60 Minutes. That's awesome.
Yeah, even 60 Minutes. You know, if you watch, you know, religious stuff on those kind of channels, chances are you have seen Ben. But he's quite a friend of Unseen Realm and just a friend and a scholar. So this is something I've been looking forward to doing for a while. Well, we're thrilled to have Ben Witherington with us for this episode of the podcast. And, you know, honestly, Ben, this is really, really long overdue. You've been a real supporter of Unseen Realm just generally, and that content, and of course have contributed to, you know, Faith Life Productions, the big, you know, film that we did on that, and other things, and, you know, mobile ed and books, and I mean, good grief, you know, this, like I said, this is long overdue. So I'm glad, you know, that this worked out, but the occasion I think is important because you have come out through Lexham with this little book, Who God Is. And when I got it and took a first look at it, and of course, you know, I've read it now because it's a short book. I mean, it's one of these little sort of books you'd carry around with you, 100 pages. But there's a lot packed in here. I mean, this is some really, there's a lot of dense theology in here packed into a short space and just sort of, you know, having the academies removed of it. So it's just really readable. And I thought, you know, this would be a great book to promote on the podcast because I think, you know, our listeners are going to just love it. But I can't wait to jump into it. And I want to jump into some of your other stuff too. But so before I sort of give way to my my little burst of enthusiasm here, you should introduce yourself because I know a lot of people in the podcast are going to know who you are. Because you have a significant online presence as well. But for those who don't, could you just tell us a little bit about who Ben Witherington is? You know, where you got your degree, what you teach, where you teach, all that sort of thing.
Sure. I'm a Tar Heel. I went to the University of North Carolina, and then I did my seminary training in New England at Gordon Conwell and at Harvard. And then, being a glutton for punishment, I went to England to do a PhD in New Testament with C.K. Barrett at the University of Durham on women in the New Testament.
And, yeah, that's really, you are a glutton for punishment.
A nice small subject, you know, right. And not controversial in any way. I mean,
right.
You know, one of the things I like about you, Michael, is you don't shy away from controversy. You just throw those theories on out there and see if anything sticks. And you know, that was kind of what I was doing with the study of the women in the New Testament as well. Wow. And what happened to me then, I don't know any other scholar this has happened to, which is that normally when you write some kind of turgid doctoral dissertation, you know, it lumbers into obscurity and people have to hunt, find it. But what happened in my case, because of the importance of the subject, not because of me, is that it became the best-selling SNTS monograph ever in the form of Women in the Ministry of Jesus and then Women in the Earliest Churches. And then they wanted the Reader's Digest version of women and the Genesis of Christianity as well. And so what happened to me is, while I'm busy pastoring four churches, the Methodist Church in North Carolina, because I'm an ordained Methodist minister, is that, you know, people, publishers started coming after me, and institutions started coming after me to hire me to teach. And so I'm one of those weird people that's almost never applied for a teaching job, nor never had to beat down the doors of some publisher to find somebody who would publish my work either.
Because that's very unusual.
Well, it's just I'm the only weird person that I know in regard to those sort of things. And so, I mean, that kind of launched my career there as a writer. And I had been a writer. I mean, actually, I had been published. My poetry had been published even when I was in high school. So I've always been a writer. I did an English lit degree at Carolina. And I would have been perfectly happy publishing and parishing for many years. Mm-hmm. But finally, Ashland Seminary, after I'd taught a little bit part-time at Duke, called me and said, well, why don't you come up here? And I said, okay, what do I get to teach? And they said, well, anything we think you're competent to teach. And I said, great. Can I teach the Old Testament and the New Testament? And they said, yes. I said, and they said, well, we really need you to teach Wesley studies since you're a Methodist. I said, that's fine. That's what I taught at Duke. Then they said, how about apologetics and world religions? I'm going, great. Okay. Wow. Cornucopia, you know. And so I went to Ashland. And the thing is that they had four campuses. Mm-hmm. So I'm failing my destiny as a Methodist circuit rider. I was going to Cleveland, Columbus, Ashland, and Detroit, darkest Detroit in the world.
Let me guess. The only thing they said no to was a teaching assistant, right?
That's about right. That's, or an office bigger than a closet. Right. You know, it's like, right. I mean, no 6 feet distancing possible from students in my former office, but oh well. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, we had 11 good years in Ashland. I was married before I went off to do my doctoral work. We had two kids and Ashland was a good place for our kids to grow up for sure. Small town, Ohio, you know, safe and all of that. And then finally, Asbury called in 95 and said, we need you down here. And it was hilarious because I went for the interview with David Bauer, the dean of the biblical studies area. And he asked me, well, which part of the New Testament do you want to teach? And I just laughed. I said, yes.
Right.
To teach at least the whole New Testament. Thank you. But the nice thing was that there was at that time only the one campus. Then eventually we had a campus in Orlando as well. So basically I wasn't running around like a chicken with my head cut off in a variety of places. And I've been there ever since. 11 years ago, we started our PhD program in biblical studies and it's really just exploded. We have now 57 students. Wow. All the assessment. It's a lot.
Wow.
So that's,
no idea it was that large.
You know, it's huge. And partly, as you will know, I mean, secular universities are paring down their ancient Near Eastern or Judaic or New Testament programs to bare nubs. I mean, Harvard's taking 2 a year, Yale's taking 2 a year. I mean, there isn't scholarships. And of course, as you know, it's labor intensive in America. It's a 5 or 6 year knock them out and drag them out program. And so we have had unbelievable applications for this program in the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, people with 4.0s and already published and this, that, and the other. So it's been fun. It's been challenging, but it's been fun. Most of the time I spend with the doctoral students, but I still teach a couple of regular graduate seminary courses a year, too.
Wow. Well, that's a full introduction, but you actually didn't even get into the things that I'm going to, and this is good. You didn't even really get into the things that I'm going to angle for today. And to give everybody, the listeners, a heads up, you know, Ben is not shy, you know, of getting into media that in turn winds up in the, on the screen, the TV, the radio, the internet now, of just the average person in the pew, the average person who wants to get biblical content. He's been an online presence for a long time, has a well-trafficked blog. It's hard to turn anything, you know, on TV when it comes to the, you know, A&E, History Channel, Discovery Channel, all this stuff that's about Jesus that Ben's not in. So this is, again, sort of the sweet spot for this podcast, you know, scholars who really try to get content to the person who's not getting a degree. You know, we've just heard about all the degree side. And that's ultimately what I want to get into toward maybe the last, you know, third or last half, you know, of what we'll do today. But really the immediate occasion is this book, Who God Is. And I'm just going to sort of get into it this way. The very first page, I'm just going to read this. I'm actually going to read you a few excerpts, and I just want to sort of hear you riff on them.
Okay.
From what was in the book, but this is the way the book starts. Something has bothered me for a long time. I'm referring to the fact that even devout Christians seem to place far more emphasis on the adjectives applied to God in the Bible than on the nouns. This is not to say that the adjectives are not vitally important. God is almighty, God is righteous, God is holy, God is merciful, God is compassionate, and so on. But frankly, nouns are more important than adjectives when it comes to the character of any sentient being, whether we are talking about God or angels or human beings. So that's a little bit of an unusual premise or starting point, but again, I'm just telling everybody, what you just heard me say, I mean, that's true. That's really true. And the book really does some very interesting things. Again, this isn't, you know, academies. There's not tons of footnotes, but this is pregnant with good, you know, biblical theology, which is really what made it appealing. And the first chapter is God is love. Now I'm going to, as I telegraphed here, I'm going to read just something here, and I'd like you and I to just sort of, again, go back and forth with it, and feel free to hammer away.
Okay.
In the part about, you know, you're leading into the God is love. In its core character as an action, love must be freely given and freely received. It cannot be coerced, and it cannot be predetermined, or else it is not love. Inherent in love is a measure of freedom. One can be wooed, one can be persuaded, one can be led to love, but one cannot be forced to love. Now, I think our listeners already know where this is going to head, at least one of the trajectories, in relationship to predestination and all that stuff. But I mean, just comment a little bit about that paragraph, you know, about love is a measure of freedom. It can't be coerced.
Well, just a little backstory to, I mean, this has been niggling at me.
Oh, I'm sure.
Ever since seminary. I mean, I'm a Methodist. I was never a Reformed person in the theological sense. But when I went to Gardner-Conwell, I really kind of wanted to hear the non-Arminian side of the evangelical Protestant argument. And boy, I got it in spades. I had Calvin, I had Burkhoff, I had Burkhauer, I had Van Til, I had, you know, you name it. I had them all and had to read them all. And Jonathan Edwards above all. And when I was in seminary and I was reading Jonathan Edwards' The Freedom of the Will, which was so titled because it was responding to Martin Luther's The Bondage of the Will. Mm-hmm. And I read the really intricate argument of Jonathan Edwards about, well, what the freedom of the will really means is not the power of contrary choice, because God has already predetermined everything. What it really means is you just don't feel compulsed. And that really fried my egg. I mean, I no, that cannot be true. That simply cannot be true. There has, because God is a moral being and he treats us as moral agents whom he expects to behave by his grace and with his aid, it cannot be true that we may seem to have actual viable choices in life, but really we don't. Really we don't, because it's all fate or predetermination or whatever. And but what worried me about studying all that and studying all that Reformed theology, what kept getting hammered home again and again was the adjectives. God is sovereign. I mean, you can just hear John Piper reciting this. God is sovereign. He's sovereign. He's sovereign. He's holy other. He's this. He's that. He's the other. And I thought, okay, true, but in what sense does God exercise his sovereignty? How does he exercise his sovereignty? Does he exercise his sovereignty like the Godfather? I'll make you an offer you can't refuse.
Right.
You will do me a favor after I will do you a favor. Or you will not do me a favor and then you will sleep with the fish.
Yeah.
I mean, that God, and every fiber of my being said, there's something really wrong with this picture of God. And so it took me a long time before it dawned on me that one of the lacunae, gaps, and that whole approach to God, however much comfort it may give you, that God is in control and he's having a good day, you know, however much that may comfort you, at the end of the day, it sure doesn't explain this central focus in both the Old and New Testament on love and on God is love. And so, you know, I finally got to the point of, I went, huh, the real problem with Reformed theology is it majors in the adjectives and just about dismisses or ignores the nouns. And I went, well, that just won't do. That's not the view of the biblical writers. And so that's ultimately what bugged me for so long that I was prompted to write this.
Yeah, and this is here's a good statement on page 11 to add to that. You wrote, "Needless to say, where one starts in describing the character of God, what one thinks is most fundamental about our God will affect how we view God's attributes, such as God's sovereignty and his righteousness. Is there something more fundamental we could say about God's character, not merely his omni-everything nature or attributes as the only living God, than that God is love? I don't think so, and neither did the one who was called Jesus' beloved disciple." Now, this is really an important point that's going to run through the whole book, that, you know, the reason you start with God is love is, again, this notion that this is the most fundamental thing. You know, the fundamental thing that God is, or, again, the noun, this is the most important of the nouns. And it guides and, you know, steers our thinking, or at least should, in relationship to all these other things. You know, it is the thing that provides the framework. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you may remember the old Mary Poppins song, or maybe it was Sound of Music. Let's start at the very, very beginning, a very good place to start. And of course, the philosophers tell you where you start an argument or a thought process, to some extent, is really going to shape and guide where you end up. And I thought, well, that's certainly true. So, you know, I sort of started asking a series of questions. Why is the great commandment, love God with your whole heart, et cetera, and your neighbor as yourself? Why is the fruit of the Spirit? Why do we start with love? Why does Paul say that faith, hope, and love are the big three, but the greatest of these is love? Why?
There's a pattern there.
Yeah, there seems to be a theme, and it's in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. I mean, for me, one of my all-time favorite Old Testament passages is Hosea 11. And not because it directly uses the word love, or some other word, but because it portrays God as a deeply compassionate person who's not going to act like a fickle human being, and especially in regard to his own people. And to me, I mean, I read Abraham Joshua Heschel, what he wrote about that. And I found it so moving. And I thought, God is the ultimate loving being in the universe, such that the author of 1 John can call him love. Okay, well, what does that mean? Among other things, it means that he freely loves us, that there is a modicum of freedom required to be able to love. And since he wants that response from us, we also must be able to do so, because it's not like the Man of La Mancha and the Impossible Quest. What God requires of us, he enables us to do. And so, I mean, it began to not only go around in my cerebral cortex, what is the character of God, but what is the character of us created in the image of God? And why all this emphasis on love? Because we're supposed to have a personal relationship with the most personal loving being in the universe.
Yeah, I mean, let me go to an example of how that emphasis affects. I mean, you bring out a lot of these, you know, it's kind of hard just to pick one. I'm going to read two things, and one is a little quicker than others. And I just want people who might be listening to this in the future, you know, to hear this, you know, cause we get listened to by a lot of people, not just, you know, believers. Right. And on page 15, you write, if the characteristic divine activity is that of loving, then God must be personal. For we cannot be loved by an abstraction or anything less than a person. And that's actually an important thought for, you know, for lack of a better label, you know, the sort of the new age spirituality. Because there's a lot of talk about, you know, love. And there's a lot of distancing from God being a personal being, as opposed to sort of some abstract force or, you know, just some sort of thing that lies behind synchronicities and all this sort of stuff, or again, this sort of living entity that's not really an entity or thing, because if it is, then boy, I could be accountable to it.
Right. It's a higher power, or maybe right. Be with you.
Those
don't tell me that there's an actual being up there.
Exactly. But that is a fundamental disconnection. That idea and love, you know, I just thought that was really important to point out. And then on the very next page, you bring this, you know, this again, core element of who God is. You go to 1 John 4:9-10, and you write, notice that in 1 John 4:9-10, God sent his son so that we might have everlasting life through him. But he also sent him as an atoning sacrifice for sin. If God is love, then no wonder a holy God is also righteously angry about our sin and must do something about it if we are to be reconciled to him. A footnote, there's the motivation. Okay, reconciliation. After all, you continue, it is sin that has destroyed our relationship with our loving God, just as sin destroys our relationship with other human beings. Love and life are the antitheses of hate and death. And yet the substitutionary sacrifice, the atoning death of Christ, is the prime example of God's love for us. Now, I wanted to bring this up because there is a, I don't know if you want to call it a movement, maybe it is a movement, but there's this sort of undercurrent about getting rid of the substitutionary aspect of the atonement. You know, I'm one of these open tent atonement people where, okay, you know, they all have something to contribute, you know, all these perspectives. But please don't use these other perspectives to, you know, nudge substitutionary atonement out of the tent. And you know, that is an over response and an overreaction. And even worse, I mean, what you just wrote in that paragraph, there's this notion that a substitutionary atonement is somehow incompatible with a loving God. And that is not the case.
No, I agree with you 100% on that one. And here's something that's really interesting to me. I mean, there's a lot of paradox in that. The greatest expression of love involved death, which gave life. But the interesting thing to me about that is the church fathers were wise enough to say that we need as many handholds and images and ideas to come to grips with the profundity of what happened on the cross, mm-hmm. including substitutionary atonement. And yet there was never an ecumenical council on atonement. Never has been. I mean, in some ways, that's astounding. We've had ecumenical councils on how many angels can stand on the... but not anything as fundamental as atonement. Yeah, we've gotten our Christology straight or our Trinity straight, but not atonement. Well, I think it's because that people get uncomfortable with one or another of these images or ideas or concepts applied to the atonement. And we would much rather have a God that is not holy love, or it's holy with a little h and love with a big L. And so, I mean, we would rather have a God like my InterVarsity kid that was in one of my InterVarsity groups, who was a brand new Christian and clearly didn't have her atonement theology straight, and said, the way I see it all works out very well. I like committing sins. God likes forgiving sins. Woohoo! Well,
there's some glare thinking right there.
not quite, because it cost God the life of his only son so that forgiveness could be possible. And so this is not cheap grace. This is not superficial love. This is a profound love that is in sync with all the other attributes of God's character. And there was only one way for that to happen, and that's through the death of his son, according to the scriptures.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of the discussion here, I think what one of the things that creates confusion is, what's God angry at? Because, you know, typically it's, well, he's angry at sin, you know, and sinners. And the way it gets talked about is God is angry at behavior. When what God is really, I mean, you said it in that paragraph, what God's really angry at is that sin has destroyed a relationship that I want. You know, it's not
right.
This is another failed performance. You know, here's a dose of wrath, you know, and then I'm going to pile all your failed performances on my son. And boy, then I really get to, you know, vent my anger, you know.
Right.
It's really misguided, but it's actually a common way, especially in, I think, among today's, you know, younger, you know, the younger demographic, you know, who've been sort of, you know, led down a path on how to think about this, that they can't see that, you know, there's a loving motivation, you know, behind this. You know, even, you know, we you know, in Unseen Realm, I get into, you know, I don't do, you know, there's not a full-blown theodicy in it, but, you know, I take theodicy back to, you know, God wants a relationship, he wants a family, and he's not going to scrap the plan. And he, you know, every time, you know, God moves, you know, to restore that which has been lost, you know, in these little incremental stages, and he's doing it with people because he's also not going to erase their freedom, because then they wouldn't be imagers anyway, and it's an admission that it was a bad idea.
Right.
I mean, God is going to work the plan as he, you know, laid out the elements of it. And he's doing that ultimately because he wants you. You know, and so, like, how could we possibly be angry at a God or dismissive of God's decisions if really the lone path to avoid wiping the pieces off the board or wiping the players, you know, off the board, you know, even out of the room, or just changing the rules in midstream, if the only way to accomplish this is the incarnation, to fulfill the covenants and to reverse the curses, how could you possibly be angry with him? I mean, how could you possibly resent that? we're just not taught.
If like Job, eventually we may need to get to the point where we have a come to Jesus meeting and realize, wait a minute, God created all this, and God has the right to set the rules about this. Who are we to question God's rules?
Yeah.
Or the way that he acts. And eventually Job, as Job says, you know, I've uttered things I shouldn't have uttered because I was ignorant. And I think that happens a lot with us. I think part of the problem, Michael, in our time is that love is such a buzzword in a particular kind of over-sexualized culture that we live in, that the danger in talking about God as love is it's going to be seen through the filter of all kinds of modern and non-biblical ways of looking at love. And the danger is that the equation is reversed to love is our God rather than God is love. And so, you know, I mean, I think there you have to really do some careful defining of what you mean, or otherwise it gets sucked up by the vacuum cleaner of our cultural assumptions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Over on page 25, you know, that since we're hitting things that obviously aren't controversial at all. Over on page 25, here's the header. And I was so gratified to see this, you know, and again, it wasn't a surprise, but it's still gratifying. Election is not salvation. You know, I mean, this is a trajectory I have gone off on because of the very obvious thing that, okay, Israel was elect, but how do we have an exile? You know, if election means salvation, what's going on there? But here we have, you know, Ben Witherington, a New Testament scholar, you know, who goes off in the same, you know, direction. So I don't know if you want to comment on that at all, but I had to throw that in because, you know, when I say that, people are like, what? You know, well, that works in the Old Testament, but not the New Testament. And here we have a New Testament scholar saying the same thing. Well,
think about Jesus just for a minute, okay? In Ephesians, amongst other places, Jesus is clearly called the elect one of God. However, Jesus didn't need to be saved. So there's something wrong with equating election in the Bible with salvation. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, when you look at what happened to Israel, they were elect, and yet, wow, lots of them fell by the wayside. And even when you get to somebody who is a chosen one, even a anointed one of God, like Cyrus the Persian, I mean, he wasn't a card-carrying Yahwist at all.
Mm-hmm.
He was elect. So there has to be some kind of distinctions between election and salvation. And to me, one of the most revealing conversations I've had in the last 10 years was with Chad Thornhill, who's a very fine New Testament scholar at Liberty.
Yeah, I read his dissertation. I was a reader. I know who you're talking about.
And what he shows is that in early Judaism, that distinction between election and salvation was pretty clear. You know, and so it's not wrong to see that in the New Testament as a further manifestation of how early Jews would have thought about these kinds of issues, for sure. So,
yeah, and if one is a subset of the other, then the subset can have this language set of them in certain contexts.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the equation that's the problem.
Oh yeah, exactly. I like to say, you're not eternally secure until you're securely in eternity. We're talking about election versus salvation. Salvation has three tenses in Paul's letters. Clearly, I have been saved, I am being saved, and I shall be saved to the uttermost when I'm fully conformed to the image of Christ. But by the way, that hadn't happened yet. So between now and then, unless you go through all three tenses of salvation, the situation is, wait for it, tense. In other words, there's the possibility of apostasy. And
yeah, we spent a lot of time on that, and we did a Hebrews series here, you know, and it's like the writer of Hebrews wouldn't have expressed this concern over and over and over again if he wasn't really concerned.
Right.
You know, that people could, you know, who had, you know, embraced, you know, the gospel. I mean, they okay, I believe it. I believe, you know, what you're telling me about Jesus. And then all of a sudden, you know, 5-10 years later, I mean, they reject it.
Right.
You know, it's not that though it's sort of unwittingly lost. Oh, I crossed the sin line here and now I've lost, you know, that's a mischaracterization.
Right.
Of the concern. Well, that they it's always about believing loyalty. It's always about that.
Absolutely, it is. And I mean, for me, when I'm reading 1 John 4, God is love, I mean, 1 John is loaded with ethical warnings. Well, what point would there be in warning a whole group of people, not just the non-elect in the group, but a whole group of people that you assume to be your beloved, as he calls them, against doing this, that, or the other, if they couldn't do otherwise? I mean, think about that for a minute.
Right. Yeah. Warnings and commands suggest that those things can happen. Yeah.
Coherence to that whole idea. Okay. I mean, I had this discussion with Greg Beale, and God bless him, one day, and we were discussing 1 Thessalonians, and I said, so who exactly are these warnings for? Oh, these warnings are for the people who are not really elect and are going to fall away. I'm going, well, what was the point of warning them if they couldn't do otherwise? Right? I mean, it sounds to me like Paul's warning everybody, because there's a tension in the Christian life in regard to this sort of issue. And the thing about love is, again, it has to be freely given, freely received, and freely responded to. It's not automatic. It's not like putting somebody on a conveyor belt and they're going to inevitably get to the finish line, come what may, do what they will.
Yeah, I'm hoping that those of you who are listening, you know, this is a book, the subtitle is Meditations on the Character of Our God. This is a lot of theology. I mean, there's a lot of theological discussion in this book. It's very short. You could read this in a couple hours, but this is the kind of thing that would be great for personal study, small group study. Honestly, if you're a pastor, I mean, there's good stuff in here that'll preach. You know, I'm just hoping this gives you a flavor. One more thing before we branch off into something else. But on page 66, you're talking about God is spirit,
right?
And you say, I take it that when he says, Jesus says, this is in John chapter 4, when he says God is spirit, number one, Jesus is talking about the Heavenly Father and his very nature. And number two, he is denying that God's nature involves materiality or flesh. And then over on page 69, again, you're still talking about John 4. You write this: Jesus in John 4 makes another crucial point. As the kingdom comes, it is not about sacred space, worshiping on Mount Gerizim or on Mount Zion, nor is it about sacred time, a holy hour necessarily. True worshipers will worship God whenever and wherever, for all the earth is the Lord's, and any time can be a sacred time, and any place can be a sacred space. But the character of true worship is to worship in spirit and in truth. And so what you do in those two paragraphs is, you know, you go from sort of an ontological observation to a more, you know, when Jesus is bringing this up to make a specific point, really, it's not just a point of application, but it is. But there's also theology there. But to how this being, you know, God who is a spirit, doesn't need, again, time and place. And I think that's a good reminder. And for many listeners out there, it may not be a reminder. You may not have heard that sort of cast that way. But especially now, you know, in these quarantine conditions, and, you know, who knows what the new normal is going to be. But this holds. I mean, this observation holds. So if you could say, a few things about those two excerpts about God is spirit, both in terms of God as a person, and then just how you apply it there.
Well, obviously, one of the implications of saying God is spirit is the Mormons are wrong.
You had to go there, right?
they're really wrong about this, that Jesus didn't have to come to earth so he could have a body, because without a body, you're just an incomplete being. No, That's not true. God is wholly other. He doesn't require a body to be entirely who he is. Not required. The point of the incarnation was for our benefit, not for God's, because he was incomplete. And so, I mean, that's part of it. But what Jesus is saying as he's bringing in the kingdom and inaugurating new covenant is, shouldn't our worship be more commensurate with the character of God? Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. God doesn't need sacrifices. He's not hungry, unlike some pagan deities. He's not lacking anything. So why are we doing what we're doing? We're doing this in order to enhance our relationship with God and further that loving relationship of freely given, freely received love of God. That's what it's about. We should be caught up in love and wonder and praise of God genuinely, you know, wholeheartedly, in spirit as well as in truth. Not truth without spirit and not spirit without truth. You know, I remember Richard Lovelace, my church historian, professor at Gordon Conwell, once saying, he said, it's like wine and wineskins. He says, wine without wineskins has nothing to give it a definite shape or to protect it or to contain it in a way that could go on serving a good purpose. But wineskins without wine doesn't vivify anything. It doesn't give life to anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have worship that's just hammering the truth at people over and over again, rather than speaking the truth in love, and it's not about being caught up in love and wonder and praise of God, as well as hearing the truth, then that's incomplete worship. That's not fully engaging the person, both mind and spirit, both emotions and will. And Jesus is saying the day is coming and now is, where it's not going to be focused on a location or, for that matter, a particular preacher or et cetera, et cetera. It should be focusing on the character of the worship and the character of the one worshiped and the one who's doing the worship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is good stuff. You know, again, the book is Who God Is, Meditations on the Character of Our God, Ben Witherington III from Lexham Press. I want to transition a little bit to get to something else, again, that I've mentioned, and that is, again, your activity as a scholar in, we'll just be very broad here, in the public sphere. Can you tell us a little bit about your blog or your blogging history? I mean, what prompted you to get started on this? And again, just to telegraph this, Ben is, again, one of a handful of scholars that when something either wacky comes along, like the Da Vinci Code, you know, years ago, I mean, it was wonderful to find your blog because it not only confirmed I wasn't the only one, but it was just good stuff, you know, because here we have a New Testament scholar that's actually taking the time to look at this thing that is sweeping sort of, you know, through the populace here. Oh, secret knowledge about the New Testament, about Jesus, and addressing that. But, you know, it wasn't just that. I mean, you address these sorts of things, but you also will address things in the academy that I think you have always had a good sense of knowing, well, this is going to trickle down either in the pulpits or maybe on the impulse shelves in the grocery store. Like the Jesus seminar or the quest for the historical Jesus, the third quest. And I mean, you'll take things like that and take them apart for a lay audience and assess them. And it's been really valuable. So could you say something about your blogging history, where people can find it? And sure. Again, just how'd you get into this?
Well, a long time ago in a land far, far away, there was a website named BeliefNet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember that.
And they asked me, would I do blogs for them? And would I be their Bible answer man? And they would just send me unlimited numbers of questions from the wild and wacky to the wonderful to give short answers to on BeliefNet. And really, that's how I got started with blogging. But I've always thought, I mean, my president of the seminary, my former president, three presidents ago now, said to me, Ben, your best gift is the ability to distill profound biblical stuff to any level of discourse. And you need to keep using that gift. And so, you know, I don't know that I'd ever thought that was my very best gift, but I realized I do have a responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in an age of increasing biblical illiteracy. I mean, you mentioned the Da Vinci Code. I actually went on a tour throughout the country for InterVarsity, talking to people about the Da Vinci Code. And the thing that struck me more than any other thing, besides just naivete of wanting to read a novel that has 150 historical errors as if it was historical facts, it was hysterical fiction, not historical fiction, you know, but the fact that the public's knowledge of the Bible or Christian understanding was so thin, even in the churches, that they were interested in this, thought, well, maybe this could be true, and then were disappointed when it wasn't true. No, Mary Magdalene was not Mrs. Jesus. Sorry. Didn't happen, you know. When Jesus rose from the dead and Mary Magdalene saw him, she didn't say, honey, I'm glad you're back. Let's jumpstart our marriage and read a Dobson book. No, that didn't happen, right?
Right.
So, but to me, that was an alarm bell going off. Our culture is going off the rails of having any kind of Judeo-Christian understanding of the Bible or the general theological and ethical truths that we stand for. And therefore, it's incumbent on people like you and me to have a public face and to be willing to talk to all kinds of people. And you know, now my blog is on Patheos. It's mm-hmm. of Bible and culture. And I get everything from zombies to devout Christians chiming onto the blog and saying all kinds of strange and wonderful things. And, you know, I try to respond to a lot of it because I think it's important. It's the same reason I've done a lot of television on various networks, really all of the major ones now, and why I think that's important, too, because, unfortunately, people don't read the Bible anymore. Even a lot of church people don't read the Bible. So you got to reach them by any good means necessary. And I take that very seriously.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I if this is inside baseball, you can tell me and you know, we can discuss it offline. But with the TV, I just have to know, okay, with the TV, is there anything you do to alleviate your concern or do you just live with it? That you're going to be edited in such a way to distort what you really think?
Well, I guess I have been really fortunate. I started doing TV all the way back in Peter Jennings' ABC days.
Mm-hmm.
He was of the mind that religion is such an important part of American culture that we need to have some shows on Jesus and Paul and early Christianity and this, that, and the other. And of course, he was right. But the people that I have dealt with, like Peter Jennings and David Gibson from CNN, and now he's teaching at Fordham, actually, or more recently, Alex Duar, who works for Newtopia, most of them had a certain level of theological understanding or chops mm-hmm. and thought that one of the key things here is to be fair to various different points of view, and all the better if we have some different points of view. So, you know, this recent one, Jesus, His Life, that we did for Discovery/History Channel, it did have some variety of opinions. Now, of course, it's always true that you don't have any control over the editing.
Right.
My worst experience was actually doing NBC Dateline during the height of the Da Vinci Code. They brought me all the way to New York, interviewed me in St. John the Divine Cathedral for like 3 hours, mm-hmm. and then interviewed me down to one word. No.
No.
So, is the Da Vinci Code historically credible? No. Okay, that was it. That was it.
Is that on IMDb?
Yes. You know, and I went.
You got a credit for it.
Well, at least I got a free trip to New York. I went and saw a play. That was awesome. Went to a concert. So, you know, so there's always that danger. But at least they didn't misrepresent me. So far, exactly. I haven't been badly misrepresented. And what I have found in these networks is that there are a lot of very thoughtful people doing television, whether it's a cable network or one of the old original networks. And many of them care deeply about this. Some of them are even genuine people of faith who really would like to get to the bottom of some of these things, you know, and treat the thing with respect. The one person I had difficulty with a little bit was Bob Simon on 60 Minutes some years ago when we were doing the interview about the James box. And you could tell he was just as sarcastic and cynical as he could be about this thing. Mm-hmm. He was not about to give this idea any credence whatsoever. But at the same time, he allowed me to answer without him correcting me. And so at least I got another opinion in addition to his. And so right. I felt okay about that.
Well, that's interesting, you know, because there are just things I regularly say no to because I can't get over the distrust hump, but I don't know. Pray for me. I don't know what to say.
You know, I think you have to, one of the things you have to do, I mean, one of the things that Paul says about himself is that you have to be prepared to be a fool for Christ in some ways and leave the results in God's hands, you know, and if you get misinterpreted, then you do, but for any audience that you speak to thereafter, you have an opportunity to say, well, that really wasn't fair. This is what I actually think. And you can talk about it on the blog, and lots of people will read that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last thing I want to, again, transition to is you also write fiction. And I think a lot of people will not know this. So can you tell us about the fiction you write and what it's about, you know, what you're trying to accomplish there, and of course, where to get it.
Sure. Again, I have an English literature degree. So my English prof, who's still a good friend, who just retired after 53 years of teaching at Carolina, wow, said, now, Ben, you're finally using your English literature degree. Finally. You're in your 60s, but you're finally doing this. Well, I'd always to do some of this. The first thing I really did was I wrote a series of archaeological short thrillers because I love thrillers and I love mysteries and I love detective stories and whatnot, about an evangelical Christian named Art West, who was good friends with a Jewish scholar at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and also with an antiquities dealer named Khalil El Said in Jerusalem. And so there was this whole series of explorations of various biblical sites and archaeological findings and exciting things. For example, finding the tombstone of Lazarus that said died 29 AD and died 45 AD, which confused a lot of people, right? Yeah, twice. Okay.
Must have been repurposed.
Exactly. So I did it not mainly for entertainment, but to emphasize the importance of history and archaeology for the understanding of a biblical faith and in an increasingly Gnostic age. I mean, really want to know my motivation. Part of it was Gnostic Christianity is not Christianity. We decided that in the second century. Let's not do it again. You know, and so I had a lot of fun doing that. I didn't ever consider it haute literature. It was just fun, you know, and lots of people enjoyed it and still do. And you can get it as a box set from Faith Life Logos even these days. So that was kind of the first venture. But then I thought I should do something more specifically to deal with the New Testament. So over Varsity Hot Dogs in downtown Atlanta with Dan Reed, my InterVarsity editor, I proposed to him a series of short novellas called A Week in the Life Of. And he obviously had eaten enough hot dog to think that that was a good idea.
Right.
And a few French fried onion rings, you know. And so we started off with A Week in the Life of Corinth. And that thing is just blown up.
Oh, really? Wow. I'm glad to hear that.
It's 12th, 13th printing now and used in a lot of classes. But what was distinctive about that whole series is not only is there the story, and you could just read the story, but there were closer look sections that actually explained some of the important historical and contextual things that you needed to understand what's going on in the story and why it's different from our world and those sorts of things. And that became wildly popular and prompted them to sign on for a whole series of those kinds of little novellas with closer look sections. And they're still going. I did one more like that called A Week in the Fall of Jerusalem. And of course, the key is to pick a key week. So sure. The first one, I picked the week of Paul's trial before Gallio in Corinth. In the week in the Fall of Jerusalem, I picked the week that the temple went down for the count. What happened to the Christians? Mm-hmm. Who fled to Pella, amongst other places. So there was that, you know, I did that. But I also wanted to do something that's a little hard to define in terms of genre. So I did something called the Gospel of Jesus. And what it is it's a narrative that puts it in some ways, it's kind of like the Dies Tesserae. It puts the whole story together in one story, mm-hmm. or gospels, and the narrator is like an omniscient narrator because it deals with Jesus's thoughts and Mary's thoughts as well along the way, as well as the thoughts of the people he runs into. And I did this to have a sort of continuous narratological flow without it being fiction. You know, all the episodes are true. Mm-hmm. Added to it is a logical extension of what's there. I've filled in a few gaps that are plausibly historical along the way. And really, that has had an incredible ministry. I mean, I actually had people go on a tour of the Holy Lands with me who had read this, who were not Christians. And I had one couple that were living together and weren't married who came on this tour. And the young man said to me, "This is the first time after I read this novel that Jesus actually made sense to me and his world made sense to me." And I thought, excellent. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. what I was really hoping for. It's not really fiction. It's not just a straight regurgitation of this verse pasted to that verse either. It's a narrative along, mm-hmm. right? And that has prompted one more of those. I've just done one for a Cascade, which they called Encounters with Jesus. And what this is each individual person whose life Jesus changed gets to speak for themselves. So
that's an interesting idea.
Blind Bartimaeus tells his own story, Lazarus tells his story, Mary Magdalene tells her story, etc., to give a more full-orbed picture of what kind of persons they were and what a difference Jesus made in their life. So,
what's the title of both of those again?
Well, the first one is The Gospel of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And the second one, it was originally entitled He Touched Them. But in our current situation, the publisher didn't like that in a world of social distancing. So we went with Encounters with Jesus.
Okay.
Well, the second one is not out yet, but it will be sometime probably later this year from Cascade.
Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah. I did one other novel for my mother's 90th birthday. I'm a great lover of Southern fiction like Flannery O'Connor and William Faulkner and all that sort of stuff. So I wrote a novel called Southern Discomfort, which is the story of a widow who doesn't want a highway paved through the front of her yard. And so, you know, it's a humorous story that I wrote for my mom. And that's done okay. But it showed me that I should stick to my primary subject, which is biblical studies and that sort of stuff.
Well, you know, did your mom like it?
Oh, she did.
Well, then it did well.
So did a lot of my relatives, because when we had the 90th surprise, we had a surprise 90th birthday party, and they all got copies of this. All my relatives, my in-laws and my outlaws from both sides of the family came, and they all got copies of this. And some of them were just laughing and laughing about this story, because in many ways, it's like the kind of Southern humor literature that Southerners love, where they get to laugh at themselves and their foibles. And that's kind of what it is. But it's also dealing with a real situation where somebody was going to be snookered out of their land by having it condemned by the state. And that just wasn't going to go well with this particular widow.
Huh. Wow. Well, that's, I mean, I wasn't aware of that last one. And the other one, of course, isn't out yet. But that actually sounds like, again, yet another thing that would be really good for, you know, people to read, not only individually, but as a group, because that's about like the Gospel of Jesus thing. And then the encounters, when that appears, that's bound to generate discussion.
Because in one way, and, you know, I think there's something, I like what C.H. Dodd says, you're supposed to tease the mind into active thought. Mm-hmm. It's okay to make a devout Christian uncomfortable for a while, if it really stirs up some deeper understanding of their God and their faith. And so, you know, I'm okay with the fact that some people will read the Gospel of Jesus and say, well, some of this you're making it up as you go along. And I said, well, it's not just fiction. It's historical conjecture that I'm doing here. And it's based on what the evidence we actually do have, right? It's not just so, it's not the Da Vinci Code in any way, shape, or form. And so, I mean, I had one publisher who looked at this and said, we like this, but we don't know what this is.
Sure.
Is it history? Is it fiction? What exactly is this? You know, and I said, well, no. It's not.
And it's to not, quote myself. From a famous episode about Jesus. No. So you got to quote yourself there, your epic line.
Exactly. So, you know, I, at this point, after writing, you know, 60 some books and writing all the commentaries I ever wanted to write, I feel like I'm playing with the house's money. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered, I mean, in terms of ministry, here's the deal. You can squeeze more theology sideways into lay people through fiction than by handing them a theological tome.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the facts. So a lot of my laity enjoy reading, you know, these fictional accounts that are faith affirming, but raise important questions that they need to think about.
Yeah. Well, this has been good. I'm glad, you know, we got to do this. We'll have to do
can I interrupt
else down there. Oh, Mike, sure.
Yeah, I was on Ben's blog, and somebody asked him last week about Matthew 16, 18 through 19, where Jesus is at the Grotto of Pan and challenges the bad guys, mm-hmm. literally as this is the rock. And I was just wondering if I could get some back and forth between y'all discussing that. If you got some time.
Ben, what?
Sure. Sure, I'm happy to do that. I think we have time, Michael.
Yeah.
My particular view on this is there is a particular reason Jesus went outside of the normal bounds of the Holy Land to Caesarea Philippi to raise the question, who do they say I am? And the reason he went to that particular place, which was Banias or renamed Caesarea Philippi, is it right there in this huge stone wall. There was this, all these niches with pagan deities, and right there was the Temple of Augustus as well, so mm-hmm. furthering the emperor cult. And surely the point is, I mean, in context is everything here, the point is, these are the pretenders, and I'm the contender. These are the parodies of which I am the reality. I really am the Son of God, and these folks are so not. the Son of God. So mm-hmm. there's a sort of dramatic contrast in the setting. And I also, I mean, I agree with you, Michael, that probably the Cave of Pan was seen as one of the portals into Hades. So what I say about that is that when Jesus says the gates of Hades will not prevail against it, that could mean nobody's going to snuff out the church. You know, it's going to be deathless. It's not a movement that's going to rise and fall. Mm-hmm. Community's going to last forever and a day. In regard to the issue of the rock, I mean, the way I interpret that is, first of all, there's actually two words there, one of which is rock, means rock, and the other which means a shelf of rocks, not just an isolated rock. So when he says, you are Kephas and all this shelf of rocks, I will build my community, what I take that to mean is that he's going to build his community on people like Peter who make this kind of confession. That's how I would interpret this. So it's not just all about Peter.
Yeah, I would, and I would emphasize the geography there, but that is not to say that what you just said isn't true.
Right.
It's kind of obviously true. You know, it has to be, because this is where everything starts. You know, right. it's this group. You know, but like he's not going to ditch them and start with somebody else.
No.
You know, so I think this is an episode that, like so many other things, you know, what I have to be a little careful here. You know, the sorts of things that you just said here, that some of that is going to be Unseen Realm 2 layering. And that's about all I'll say, you know, to that. Right. But this is like so many other things, not just in the Gospels, but, you know, in Scripture, that it's unusual to encounter passages that not only have some pretty, you know, deep theology going on, but that occur in places with deep histories.
Right.
And the theology serves not just one trajectory, but several.
You know, I mean,
it's really hard to find much in Scripture that isn't that way. And again, I think that's intentional. I think that shows the intelligence, not only of, you know, not only the writers, but, you know, the spirit who's prompting them, but just sort of the overall story.
I think, you know, in the Markan context, this is really critical. I mean, to me, obviously there's a general chronological structure to the Gospel of Mark, but there's also a theological structure. And what I mean is, in the first eight chapters of Mark, you have the who and why questions raised. Who is this masked man? Who's this who can walk on water? Why are his disciples eating with the sinners? And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then the who question is given a partial answer in Mark 8 by Peter, even though it's clear from what immediately follows, he doesn't understand all the implications of that. But it's not an accident that it's not until then that we have a fourfold Jesus explaining the Son of Man must suffer many things, be killed, and on third day rise in various forms. And then in chapter 10, following even those three in three straight chapters, you have 10:45, I came to not be served, but to serve and give my life as ransom for many. In other words, you have to answer the who question before you can understand why he came and why he had to die. Mm-hmm. In terms of a theological structure. And then that goes immediately into Mark 11 and following, which is the Passion narrative. So there's a very simple theological structure. Raise the right questions about Jesus, have the question about who he is answered, then explain what was the mission, and then explain mission accomplished. That's a theological structure. Mm-hmm. And the pivot is that Mark 8 story at Caesarea Philippi.
Yeah, you know, and writers, brace yourselves, you know, writers make decisions, you know, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not always going to make, you know, the same decisions, and that's okay, because, you know, every writer has an audience in mind, a goal in mind, an agenda in mind. None of these are bad things. And they're also not self-contradictory, you know, mutually contradictory things. You know, this is just the nature of the enterprise.
Right.
And, you know, it's important, you know, to recognize the layering, you know, and in a book like Unseen Realm, I've just been surprised at how many times I have to remind people of this. Okay. Did you read like the introduction? You know, this is not a theory of everything. This is, to quote myself, this is the starting point. Okay. This is the beginning. Right. This isn't the end. This is where we start. I'm trying to give you a framework into which the other things fit. And then, you know, Lord willing, we will add layers. You know, we'll add new things that fit into the framework, or we will, you know, expand something so that you can see it from a different angle, you know, within the framework here. But this is one of those ways where I think that the book has sort of, it's become popular enough where people think that like, this is like the book, you know? Well, no, it's not the book. It's a starting point. It's exactly what I said it was.
Right.
You know, there's no end, you know, honestly, I mean, there's just no end to how you could accrue these kinds of things, and still you still have the structure, but the picture just, you know, it becomes more full. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, I use the puzzle analogy and all that sort of thing. I mean, you can look at a partially complete puzzle. Okay, I know what that's about. I know what that's going to be. You know, that's good. But you know, you can sort of appreciate the intelligence of it, you know, how this thing was created, and even the beauty of it once it's fully assembled, when you have the whole thing. Well, this is what we're trying to do. We're just trying to, each step, each little thing that's created, trying to give you a little bit more fullness to the picture. But I mean, in that would just never end.
Well, and so, you know, to me, one of the things I've noticed about the reaction to your book is there are quite a lot of people for whom it was unsettling, but the reason usually why it was unsettling is because it forced them to take seriously the supernatural. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, even devout Christians have a hard time coming to grips with angels and demons and that sort of stuff. And so for some of them, they're going, whoa, really? Is that who the Nephilim are? Oh, and is that why the conquest went the way it did? You know, and to me, that was a very revealing thing to see how they reacted to some of those ideas. Mm-hmm. Because the real truth is, we are all still post-enlightenment, post-modernity yeah. people. Yeah. And our default is not to immediately jump to a discussion of what are the roles of other worldly beings in our lives, but rather to explain things with natural causes and this, that, and the other, even if you're a devout Christian person. So, yeah.
You know, I think you can appreciate this because you have interacted with the public for a long time at a thoughtful level. And you know, sort of the trajectories that are going to be meaningful to an unbeliever, you know, who desperately wants to tear the biblical story down, desperately needs it not to be true.
Right.
And I'm going to say this, that there's something brewing within the world of I'll say evangelicalism, but even the conservative evangelical wing of that. And that is, I think there's going to emerge a resistance to the way Unseen Realm makes people think about the supernatural. And it's not because, how can I say this? It's not because there's any sinister intent. That's not the case. It's not the case at all.
No.
But I think it's a failure to see how the unbelieving world, there's going to be people out there, and there's going to be a few clever ones, a few that have very loud voices, but there's going to be a lot of them just numerically that will instantly see, okay, you're accepting certain things that this book says about the supernatural world. You accept some of them, and they're really important to you, but then you reject others. Other things that the same book says about the supernatural world, and you either assign less importance to them or you demythologize them.
Right. Yeah.
So how are you being consistent?
Well,
why should I align my faith? Why should I put faith in the things that you say are, we can believe these, and then just sort of pretend that these other things aren't there? I mean, how? Give me a reason to believe this set of things while you simultaneously reject these others, because they come from the same source and they're about the same thing. This, we're not talking about, you know, the world of nature and, you know, something you can put under a microscope and test with a natural sign. We're talking about the spiritual world. Okay. That inconsistency, I think a lot of evangelicals are blind to the fact that if they do that, there are going to be a lot of people who will notice and who will use it as a wedge to not only to not believe, but to prevent other people
from. Yeah. Oh, yes, I think that's right. And you know, I mean, one of the things I appreciated in your book is it made even devout Christians nervous in the service in a good way, in a good way. It made them really, really, really rethink what the default was. I will tell you a short story. When I was going up to be ordained a deacon in the Methodist Church, because we had two levels of ordination there, so it was my first ordination before I became an elder. This was at the beginning of the charismatic movement in the early 70s in the Methodist Church. And so they started asking me some theological questions. And then they sent me to the conference counselor. And he turned on a bank of cassette tapes and said, okay, first of all, do you believe there's a personal devil? I said, yes. He said, do you believe there are demons out there in the world bewitching, bothering, and bewildering people? I said, yes. Do you believe in angels? I said, yes. That delayed my ordination for a year.
Wow.
Yeah. They also asked me, do you believe in speaking in tongues as a real spiritual gift and that sort of stuff, which I also said yes to. And so, but the thing that struck me, I mean, was, among other things, my own naivete. Mm-hmm. I just assumed these are my elders. They are sincere Christian people. Of course they believe in these things. Mm-hmm. Not so much.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And,
or at least they found it deeply troubling.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what can you say? I mean, I just think that this is already brewing, you know. And again, my concern isn't that readers agree with Mike. My concern, I mean, this has emerged as the chief concern in my head and my heart, that there will be people who will think nothing of this inconsistency. You know, they'll think nothing of what it means for the unbeliever who's being asked to believe the subset, but not the other stuff. I think it's going to matter, you know, for just general apologetics, just, you know, yeah, how we approach, you know, the Bible. It's a question of biblical authority. You know, I think there's going to be a significant number, and I'm talking evangelical scholars as well, who somehow either can't see this as really problematic, or they resist seeing it as problematic. And well, I think that's going to cause some harm, you know, both within and outside the church.
Well, what I see happening, you know, because of my connections with University Christian Fellowship, is the deep lust for tangible certainty about all kinds of things, including your eternal security, right? And the fear that if you open your mind to some of the things that are in the unseen realm, well, then things suddenly get squirrely because I don't have control. You know, if it's just a set of ideas that I need to stand up and salute the flag of, that's one thing. If there are really creepy crawlies out there in the world, like demons and the devil, well, then, wow. I can't control my world and my future just by learning a set of facts or theological or ethical doctrines and getting my ducks in a row. All of a sudden, I have to rely on God all the time. he's the 500-pound gorilla who overrules all that sort of stuff, right? And so I think, I mean, it's in this age especially, it's profoundly unsettling to a lot of even evangelical folks or those who have grown up in evangelical families.
Yeah, and it, what's really troubling, even as in the way you describe that, is we, again, there's a group within evangelicalism that has convinced themselves that they do sufficiently understand how the Trinity works, how the incarnation works.
Right.
You know, and the reality is, actually, you don't. You can't explain those things within a naturalistic framework. You can pretend that you're intellectually sort of safe there, but it's just not true. You know, you're deceiving yourself, because none of those things conform to a naturalistic approach to reality, to scripture. Yeah. Not to scripture, but just to the whole question of, is the only thing that is real, the material world. And, these things escape that sort of, set of assumptions. But again, I just don't think that people see the magnitude of the inconsistency. But there will be people, again, who are enemies of the faith, or Christians who are, unduly influenced, again, by the discussion or by something they'll see on TV or whatever, that will not be able to recover, from this, or will use it as a tool, again, to steer people away from the gospel.
Or even in their own life, to hold God at bay in their own life. Like, no, I don't have to, and that's another thing I really learned from the whole touring around the country about the Da Vinci Code, is people were looking for permission not to take seriously all this stuff in the Bible. They were looking for permission to take a very pick and choose approach to things in various ways. And what I was saying was, actually, no, Dan Brown's not a good theologian or a good historian. And no, you don't have a permission to do that. This is God's word. And it's not your opinions about God's word. It's God's word. And as such, you need to take it all much more seriously.
Yeah. Well, Ben, thank you for being with us. Again, I'm sure the audience will be provoked and challenged in good ways, just to think about things agree or dispute with you in their head. But that's a good thing, because there's something happening there then.
Absolutely. It's actual thinking is happening.
Right. Yep. Absolutely. And, we appreciate, too, again, especially this audience, just the effort to do something for the masses. It's important, especially in this culture. Lord willing, there will be more, people from this generation who are sort of used to the interaction, interactive media and such, that will emerge as scholars who do that. But I mean, you're way ahead of the curve, for that. So we appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure, Michael. I'm happy to help any way I can, and I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Mike. I had to jump in there and ask that question because I was not ready for you and Ben to quit the conversation, so I had to keep it going there.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. I mean, Ben, we've had, I think listeners can tell, we've had conversations about this or that, because he'd pop in at Faith Life every now and then. We do lunch, and you see him at conferences. So yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. And what was his book again, that you referenced there?
The most recent one is Who God Is: Meditations on the Character of Our God.
All right, Mike. Well, that was a great conversation. We appreciate Ben coming on. And with that, I want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.